ప్రజ్ఞదహికా శక్తి రామకృష్ణే స్థితాహియా సర్వవిద్యాస్వరూపాం తాం శారదాం ప్రణమామ్యహం. I bow to Sri Sharada Devi, the embodiment of all wisdom, who dwells within Sri Ramakrishna like the burning power in fire. Good morning, everyone. Holy Mother's birthday is coming up. The Titi is Wednesday, and we will celebrate next Sunday. And Saturday night, we'll chant the 108 names of Holy Mother. Everyone is invited for that. I had an idea to speak about the teachings of Holy Mother, and then I thought that I should make a snappier title for the whole thing. So I put, "From the Lips of Holy Mother." Then it struck me, there's an interesting irony there. Can anybody think of... Very few people heard her speak. From the lips of Holy Mother, because she was so shy. Very few people saw her face, but also she barely could speak loud enough for other people to hear her. Half the time, Yogin Ma or Golab Ma would have to be by her side, and she would whisper something, and they would repeat it when people came to ask her questions. So we don't get too much that people actually heard from the lips of Holy Mother. There were times, of course, and when she was alone with the mostly women devotees or the younger ones or Anjaran Bhatti or something, but even then she was so shy that she was reticent about being seen and also being heard. So she spoke very quietly. And the other thing is that I doubt if Holy Mother ever thought of herself as giving teachings. It wasn't exactly her style or the method, or I don't think she thought of herself in that sense, that she was a teacher, or she was certainly not a speaker or a lecturer or anything, but her life was mostly her teaching. And at the same time, she made certain statements, and we have a whole booklet of her teachings that we can call her teachings. Now, how different are they from the teachings of Sri Ramakrishna? It's another interesting question that some people will say that quite different. Some people will say not different at all. Some people will say, well, a little bit different, but it depended on context. If you really dig deep, you'll find that there's no difference at all. I'll be somewhere in between. And I want to talk about some of the teachings that are a little bit particular to Holy Mother, but at the same time, we won't find anything that she said that will contradict anything that Sri Ramakrishna said, and almost nothing that can't be traced back to him also. So I want to go through some of the important teachings, some of the things we know very well, some not quite so well, the ones that we've heard so much about, especially her final message. I will speak about, not in as much detail, because we've had so many talks on that. We had a beautiful talk by Swami Sarvadevananji recently on Holy Mother's teachings on contentment. So I'll just briefly refer to that. But I do want to emphasize the fact that Holy Mother had this knack and this genius for instructing people and for always giving the right answer to everything. So much so that the direct disciples would trust her word more than anything else. They trusted her judgment more than their own judgment. Even Swami Vivekananda, and we know that there are many stories like that. One of the things we find when we look at the teachings of Holy Mother is not simply how similar they are to the teachings of Sri Ramakrishna, but how, in some cases, word for word, how they go directly back. Now, I mentioned this as something interesting because we have a picture of Holy Mother of being stuck in the Nahavat, And Sri Ramakrishna has a room full of devotees, and she can't hear anything. Huh? She has to spend long hours peeping through the space, the crack in the bamboo curtain there, just to see what's going on. But two things. One, when we hear her teachings, and secondly, when we see her reaction to reading of the Kothamrita, the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, we find that she must have spent a lot of time directly with him hearing his teachings. When M read out the first sections of the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, or other people read it after her, I don't remember, she said, Baba, this is exactly the way he said these things. So that means that there must have been long periods, I would say probably before the direct disciples started coming, say in the 1870s, something like that, when Holy Mother would bring food for Sri Ramakrishna, there would be nobody else there. She would be sitting alone with him, and he would give her instructions on all sorts of things, practical things as well as spiritual things, so that she learned all of these. She heard all of these things directly from Sri Ramakrishna. It's not like she heard people reading them out from reading the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. She must have heard these things directly. So my conviction is that our understanding is sometimes based too much on that later period of her life, that there was a time when she had much more free access, and when Sri Ramakrishna was intent upon giving all of this his spiritual wisdom to her, or awakening it in her, because he knew that Holy Mother would have to take over for him, and that she would have to be the one who would play the role of the spiritual guide. In fact, many times he told her, you'll have to do it, and she would say, no, what can I do? I'm only a woman, she would say. In those days, of course, women had to be in the background a little bit. And he said, no, you'll have to do far more than I've done. So he was preparing her. So many of the things that we'll hear, these different teachings, we know go directly back to her direct conversations and with Sri Ramakrishna and the things that he said to her. Now, just for fun, I am going to start out with some things that seem a little bit different. Mostly it'll be a little bit different in emphasis, or maybe, you know, Holy Mother was so soft in her nature that this may be the reason for some of it. But I want to start out with this idea of truthfulness. Now, we know that Sri Ramakrishna was very fanatical about telling the truth. He was so fanatical about telling the truth that towards the end of his life, when he felt that it wasn't so strong with him, it was a little bit of a relief. He used to say, formerly I was much more devoted to this truth-telling thing. It was almost type of a fanaticism with him. Now, not quite so much, so he was relieved of it a little bit. But we know if he said anything, if by chance he said that he would visit somebody's house and then he forgot, and he discovered that it was 5 minutes before midnight, and he said, oh, I was going to do it today, I have to do it before midnight, and he would go and he would open up the gate and stick his foot in and say, I've come, and then he would leave, knowing that no one would hear him. He has that type of devotion to telling the truth. So there are many, many stories like that about Sri Ramakrishna, even simple things. He used to go to the pine grove to answer calls of nature. If he asked somebody to carry his water pot for him, and then somebody else did it, he said, oh, then I can't, what can I do? I'm stuck. I can't do anything. Go get the other person. I told him to do it, not you to do it. So he was very fanatical about that. Now, Holy Mother, as I say, she was soft about things. She was a little more flexible. So she emphasized kindness over truthfulness. Not that Sri Ramakrishna didn't. Don't get me wrong. He also understood that we shouldn't speak an unkind truth. But for Holy Mother, this was a greater point of emphasis. So she said it one time. Should anyone utter a thing that hurts another's feeling? An unpleasant truth, though true, must not be uttered, for that grows into a habit. By indulging in rude words, one's nature becomes rude. One's sensitivity is lost if one has no control over one's speech. And once a person casts off all consideration for others to the wind, he stops at nothing. Then she added something just so that we know that she is following Sri Ramakrishna. This is also something she got from him. The master would say, if you have to ask a lame man how he became lame, there's no need to even use the word lame. You can simply ask him lovingly if something has happened to his leg. So this sweetness element was there. Now, another example, this is a good example because on the surface of it, it sounds like they're giving exactly opposite teachings. Sri Ramakrishna used to say, Lojja Ghrina Bhoy Tin Thakte Noy, that one should be free from shame, hatred, and fear. Now, Holy Mother said the exact opposite. Lojja Ghrina Bhoy Tin Thakte Noy. That, now, what did she mean? By lojja, she meant modesty, not so much shame. And because she emphasized this, Ramakrishna also to a certain extent, but Thakur's idea was that we had to be bold and fearless, that these are all signs of the ego, that I don't want to be embarrassed about this, I don't want to be afraid of that. This is all the ego-driven things. But Holy Mother's idea was that one should practice modesty. This is also something against the ego. One should practice modesty. One should live in this world carefully. Not fearfully, but we know there are dangers in life. So we have to be cautious when we live in this world. And we have to pay attention to things. We have to avoid people who may do us harm. We have to just understand the nature of this world that way. So that there are pitfalls. There are dangers in this world. Third example, and as I keep saying, we'll see that these are just two sides. They're not real differences, but Sri Ramakrishna often spoke about something which strikes us as a very harsh truth, that he would say, remember that no one is your very own but God. God alone is your very own. He used to sing that song, Bhebi Dakmon, Ke O Karunoi, that remember, O mine, no one is your own. You're wandering vainly through this world. That God alone is your own, very own person, the only one we can rely on. So he would emphasize that to a great extent. He would tell some very harsh stories, and we know some of these stories, that the disciple said to the teacher, that how can you say no one is my own? Everyone loves me so much at home. And he said, oh yeah, do they? Let's put it to the test. I'll give you a pill. It'll make you unconscious when you go home. They'll think you died, and then I'll show up. We'll see what happens. So everything goes according to plan. Everyone's weeping and wailing. The wife's husband had died. The mother's son had died. So the man goes in and says, what happened? And they said, look, suddenly he just died like that. What will we do now? And he said, don't worry, I can fix it. I have a medicine that I'll give it to him and he'll survive. They were all very happy. And then he said, but one thing, one of you will have to take one of these pills first. And they said, okay, we don't mind. They said, but the person who takes it will die. And then one after another, a little hemming and hawing, well, you know, we love to bring him back, but I have other things to do. We have other children to look after, this and that. And as they're going on like that, then the disciple starts to get his movement back and consciousness. He was listening the whole time. And then he said, all right, let's go. Now I understand that no one is my own but God. It's a very harsh story. We know what Thakur is trying to get at. He's trying to tell us, rely on God. Now, Holy Mother, and this is, of course, part of her final message, emphasized this idea that no one is a stranger. Ke opornoi. She used to say that no one is a stranger, the whole world is your own, that we should feel kinship and oneness with everyone. It doesn't mean that she also didn't think we should rely on God. It didn't mean she was trying to say something contrary to what Sri Ramakrishna said, but if we look at the context a little bit, Sri Ramakrishna, most of his teachings, even though the ones we have recorded were on a Saturday or a Sunday or a holiday when M could go, Most of the time, if we look carefully, we'll find that at least one or more of the future direct monastic disciples was present. And very often, even though there's a room full of household devotees, he'll start saying things that are meant more specifically for the future monks. And he was trying to give them that feeling of dispassion. Now, Holy Mother heard message. She could be in a room full of monks, but she was always conscious of the life of the householder. In fact, if we want to make a distinction between the two, I really think Sri Ramakrishna came as a little bit more of the perfect sannyasi, and Holy Mother a little bit more of the perfect householder, even though she also had that perfect renunciation, and even though Sri Ramakrishna also never took any type of outer dress of a sannyasi or anything. He lived in one place. He looked after his mother, so many other things. But this emphasis that Holy Mother placed was more on this idea of looking upon everyone as our very own. Now, the interesting thing is that, and I discovered this a couple of weeks ago, this phrase, "Ke opornoi," no one is a stranger, was uttered by Sri Ramakrishna himself. Yeah, in the gospel itself. If you read it, I don't remember where it was or the context, who he was talking to, but he said exactly those three words, same exact words, that no one is a stranger. So he had that same attitude. It just depended on whom he was talking to and what the occasion was and the context and what he was trying to teach. So both are true, that we want to fully rely on God. At the same time, we want to feel one with everyone. We don't want to think of anybody as a stranger. Now, if there's any area where a legitimate case can be made for a difference in their teachings, I would say it's with regard to work. When we read the gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, we find that, as I said before, either there are future monastic members there, or many times there were older devotees there who had reached the stage of the retired life, Vanaprastha stage. So when we read about the advice to Ishan, he gave this advice to Ishan that why do you get so involved in being an arbitration and doing all these things and mixing up, solving arguments and everything? Now is the time to give up all of your work and to spend all of your time calling on God. So this special teaching applies specifically to those who will renounce the world at a young age and become monks, or those who have reached that age where they really can, it's only their attachment that keeps them engaged in work, they really can give up and really can spend more of their time in spiritual practice, and they don't have to get involved in all of these other things, which half the time is just because we need something to do. Right? Especially that retired stage of life. When we're younger, of course, there's the job, there's looking after children, there's so many things that have to be done. But Sri Ramakrishna says some people, they, in their old age, there's nothing to do, they'll get a cat. I have nothing against cats. I like dogs better. But it's nothing against pets. I mean, it's a nice thing. It's very nice for older people, actually. But his point was that half of it is to avoid the real work of our life is calling on God and having some type of higher realization. Holy Mother, on the other hand, emphasized always keeping busy, always doing something, never being idle. And this is something that she put into practice in her life. And she would tell people, look at me. If there's nothing to do, then I'll start rolling the pond, the beetle leaf and beetle. She'll do that. If that doesn't have to be done, she'll be kneading flour. If that doesn't have to be done, she'll be darning something. Or she'll take these old fiber and things and make mats for people to sit on. She was always doing something. And she recommended that, even for monks, that not to remain idle, that do something constructive. And she had many beautiful teachings about this. She said, it is essential that one should work. It is through work alone that one may break asunder the bonds of karma. Only then is one free from desire. One shouldn't be without work even for a single moment. Do the master's work, and along with that, practice spiritual discipline too. Work helps one to keep off idle thoughts. If one is without work, such thoughts rush into one's mind. And then, how can one's mind be healthy if one doesn't work? No one can spend all 24 hours in thought and meditation. So one must engage oneself in work. It keeps the mind cheerful. This is also one of the reasons why Swami Vivekananda emphasized that the monks of the order should be engaged in productive work. And it's not always social service work. Sometimes it's keeping accounts in the office or running a bookstore, all sorts of things. Ultimately, it's for the benefit of society. But partly because most people are not capable of spending all of their time in spiritual practice. So we should do something constructive. It's a very, very important teaching. She was a perfect example of that, and she would give that teaching, as I say, to the young boys, to the monks, to the householders, to everyone. Then one final point of some slight distinction between the teachings of Holy Mother and Sri Ramakrishna has to do with spiritual practice. Now, Sri Ramakrishna, he divided spiritual life into two stages. Sometimes he called it two different stages of bhakti, of devotion. The lower one he called Vaidhi Bhakti, and this is where we do everything according to a prescription, according to teachings, following the instructions of the guru, having a very strict routine, where we'll wake up at a certain time each day, we'll do a certain amount of japa and meditation and prayer and puja and spiritual reading, all of that, that we'll try to keep to a steady program of one thing after another, and this will become a habit with us, and we'll try to be very regular with this. This is Vaidhi Bhakti. Then Sri Ramakrishna said, through that practice, one reaches a stage which he calls Raga Bhakti, or Anuraga. He uses different terms, where the mind is so spontaneously geared towards spiritual thought that there's no need whatsoever of keeping any strict routine. And he emphasized this, and this is the stage which we can say corresponds to this feeling of Vyakulata, this intense yearning and longing for God realization. Now, if we look at the lives of Sri Ramakrishna and Holy Mother, we find in Thakur's case that he began with this Vyakulata state. He began with this Anuraga. He never had to go through the preliminary state. From the very moment that he started worshiping Mother Kali in the Kali temple, he was consumed with this idea. I must know, who is this mother that I'm worshiping? And he never said, okay, let me wake up at a certain time and do a certain amount of japa and I'll keep track and all. Because he was going through this tremendous storm, this dust storm where you can't see one place from another. He didn't know day from night. He said that for 6 long years he hardly slept. And he said he hardly ate anything, and sleep left him completely. Now, we can't imagine someone like that thinking in terms of doing any type of regular spiritual practice. It was impossible, not just unnecessary, it was impossible. And Thakur had reached that state, even doing japa. There was one incident, I think it was Hazra, it must have been Hazra. He saw him sitting there and telling his beads, doing japa on the japa mala. And then he said, oh, I see, let me see. That looks interesting. Let me see if I can do it. So he took the mala from his hand, and he said, no, let me try my left hand. And he took it to the left, and he said, okay, I can do it a little bit. And then he gave it back. So this, everything was literal in Sri Ramakrishna's case. So this was his way of saying that when one reaches that upper level of ecstatic love for God, then these things fall off. They're absolutely not necessary whatsoever. Now, He understood, of course, and told everybody that you had to be regular in spiritual life in order to reach the stage. But this is the stage that he emphasized more. In fact, he said, all of our spiritual practices, all of our japa, all of our meditation, all of our prayer are meant for one purpose only. And that is so that we can cultivate this longing for God. They're meant for that. We get so many different teachings that the japa and meditation, it's for purity of heart. It's for concentration of mind. These are all true. But his point of emphasis was that the importance of them, or holy company, the importance of them is that it leads to this tremendous restlessness, tremendous longing for God. Now, in the Holy Mother's case, both in her life and in her teachings, she puts more emphasis on the Vaidhi-bhakti stage. Because we see Holy Mother was born to set a different type of example. And in her life, she was very committed to this act of japa, even keeping track of the number of times. She would spend long, long hours in with her beads, and she would recommend that. So her emphasis was always on this lower stage, knowing that that leads to the higher stage. Whereas for Sri Ramakrishna, his emphasis was on how can we attain this tremendous longing for God realization. He would also say, through sadhana, that through our spiritual practice we can get to it, but that was more his point of emphasis. So we find this slight distinction that Holy Mother put tremendous value on japa. She used to say, japat siddhi, that one can attain perfection just through japa. And japa, she didn't emphasize the counting so much, but she didn't disregard it either. So she would usually repeat a certain number of times, something like that. She said, don't get too involved in this process of keeping count, fingers and everything, but she would give a certain amount to do. So very often her teachings would be with regard to the japa, and we see it in her life also. Many, many examples can be given. She received a letter from one of her disciples one time who claimed that he was unable to meditate, that he couldn't concentrate his mind. What should he do? Half the time they wanted Holy Mother to simply say, oh, my child, don't worry, I'll pray to Thakur, you'll be fine, nothing, you don't have to do anything. They were lazy, many of her disciples. They would all say, oh, why don't I see Thakur? Why don't I see Thakur? She said, what have you done to see it? Is he a fish salesman? That you think you give a certain amount of money and you get a fish in return? It's not like that. So when Holy Mother heard this, because they would read out these letters to her, she became agitated, and she said, it can be done. That means calming the mind, concentrating the mind. If one repeats the name of God 15 or 20,000 times each day. Now, how long will that take? Huh? For some people, almost all day. Depends how fast we do. And maybe not so long, but at the normal speed, we're talking about hours, long hours. You know about Swami Virajanandi, her disciple, Swamiji's sannyas disciple, the Holy Mother's mantra disciple. He would do 100,000, 120,000. He was really recovering from an illness and more or less bedridden at the time. He was young, but he had malaria. So he would spend the whole day. Even that, if you're spending the whole day, you have to really go fast. Yeah. And it'll take 18 hours to do that much japa. So Holy Mother emphasized this. So she said, let him do that first. And afterwards, talk about it if it fails. Because she said that it can be done. I have seen it actually happen, she said. Let him do that first and talk afterwards if it fails. So this was a very common thing with her. Whenever anyone would complain, she would say, how much japa do you do? And the most common advice seems to be 20,000 times. Now, don't even try it. I won't even. Maybe one day or a whole lifetime we can try to do that. But what she was saying was, do something. Don't just complain. It's spend some time with your spiritual practice. She gave a very nice illustration about the japa, because for her, japa was sitting and counting and everything, but even when we're not, that it should be going on, like a song, going on over and over and over again. This is called a japa. She said, pointing to a clock on the wall, as that timepiece is ticking, so also go on repeating God's name. That will bring you everything. Nothing more need be done. Now, I want to turn to the two teachings, which are actually three, but two main statements that Holy Mother made, which we generally consider to be the most important. One, of course, is her final message. We know that. The second one, as I referred to earlier, was spoken about by Swami Sarvadevananji when he was here last. And if you weren't here, or you didn't get to hear it, or you want to hear it again, it was a very beautiful talk, and it should be available on our website. So you can go back and try to find that and listen to that. So I'll talk about that teaching first. It was a statement that Holy Mother made. It says, Shodjo Shaman Gunnei, Shonto Shaman Donnei. That there is no virtue comparable to forbearance. And there's no treasure, there's no wealth comparable to contentment. And Swami Sarvadevananda spoke about contentment that day. This idea of forbearance was something that Holy Mother emphasized, and also perhaps the dominant spiritual quality. Perhaps she is the greatest example of this forbearance that we can imagine in many respects. So this is something that we can associate with Holy Mother. When we think of Holy Mother, we should think about her tremendous power of forbearance. She used to say, and these are all things she heard from Sri Ramakrishna, Jai Shoy, Shai Roy, Jai Na Shoy, Shai Na Shoy. Thakur liked to have these little rhyming things, that those who are able to forbear, Jai Shoy, they alone will survive. And those who can't do it, they'll perish. So very nice. Jai Shoy, Shai Roy, those who can forbear will remain. They'll survive. Denashoy, Shenashoy. Those not, then they'll perish. Because we can't change things all the time. We have to learn to put up with things, with the physical pain, with tragedies that occur, so many different things that we have to learn how to deal with these things. So this idea of titiksha, this idea of forbearance, was very, very important with the Holy Mother. We have a few elements of this that we talk about. There's a very famous verse from Viveka Chudamani, which gives a few essential features of forbearance. One of them is a little bit easy. The other one is impossible. This one is that it has to be free from chinta. That means we shouldn't be anxious. That we have some physical pain, we have some illness or something like that. We don't worry about it all the time. That the roof is leaking, everything. We don't worry about it all the time. And vilapa, we don't complain. So no anxiety, no complaining. These are the two easy parts. The other one is we don't try to remedy the problem. Now, most of us won't do it, and we shouldn't follow this one. This is for just a handful of very, very austere monks. Even in our order, very few followed this. Sri Ramakrishna, how many times he went to the doctor? The slightest complaint, he said, call the doctor. Huh? How many times he took medicine and everything? We have one shining example. That was Swami Vijñānananda, that he used to quote this verse, that what is medicine? Water from the Ganges is my medicine. And who is the doctor? The Hari is a Vaidya. The Lord himself is the doctor. I don't need anything. So he used to refuse every a little homeopathic medicine, maybe at the very end. But otherwise, he would refuse. He would say, whatever comes, I can forbear. That's all. I can put it up with it. We can't do that. So we have to modify this a little bit, and we have to say that, well, once I make moderate, reasonable effort to fix something, to solve a problem, if that doesn't work, then I put up with it. That's all. So it means we don't go overboard, that we don't run here and there. We accept the fact sometimes that that there will be difficulties and problems and illnesses and diseases and ailments, all sorts of things in life, that this is the nature of life. And if we learn to put up with it, then we can have contentment. So this contentment will follow, actually, from that. So this other one, na pratikaram purvakam. This we really can't do. The reason why it's stated is that we're trying to have perfect reliance on God, sharanagati. But as I say, we have to be sensible people also. Swami Swanaji used to tell a nice story about this forbearance. And there was a man who had a very painful physical condition, and he went from doctor to doctor trying to get a cure for it. And each doctor said, no, there's nothing we can do about this. So finally, he went to a fortune teller. And the fortune teller said, yes, I see that you're suffering from this. You'll suffer for another 10 years. And then he said, and after that? She said, after that, you'll get used to it. So this is that idea behind forbearance. We can get used to anything. Really, there are people who have this tremendous power of forbearance. Swamiji used to say that the great feature of the West is that they try to fix everything. The great feature of India is they can put up with anything. Yeah. So if we have it, this power of forbearance is really a tremendous thing. Now, in the life of the Holy Mother, what was it that she had to practice such forbearance about? Physically, she had pain in her legs. She had rheumatism. She would get fever from time to time. Nothing unusual. Everybody suffered from those things. Huh? Nothing compared to Sri Ramakrishna's cancer in his throat, which would have been, for an ordinary person, would have been absolutely unbearable. In the case of Holy Mother, it was not so much physical things, but the circumstances that she found herself in. Family circumstances, all sorts of different things that required her to practice this tremendous type of forbearance. We look at her life when she was living in Dakshineswar, how she was able to live in this tiny little room where you can't even stand up. You have to bend down to even get inside. She had to do all of the cooking and keep all of the vegetables and things there. Sometimes she had a companion sleeping there. She had to get up like 3 in the morning before anybody else was up, pitch dark, just to answer the calls of nature, to take her bath. She couldn't even dry her hair until the afternoon. When everyone else was sleeping, she could go up to the roof and let her hair dry a little bit. So long hours where she's dying to have the company of Sri Ramakrishna and just has to look through the bamboo curtain. So all of this took a tremendous amount of forbearance, all of these things. The whole day not being able to use the bathroom. Can you imagine? Day after day after day. Either early morning or when everyone is sleeping late afternoon. Yeah, so it was a tremendously difficult life. And forbearance doesn't mean that, oh, she managed to put up with it. Because she used to say, yeah, people say, oh, how difficult life was for little Sharada in those days. She said, but I felt as if my heart was filled with a picture of bliss day and night. It was the most joyful period of her life. So that means that this power of forbearance will make us forget the suffering and all the difficulties of life. Now, what would have been the greatest test for Holy Mother with regard to forbearance? Anybody? Any suggestions? Radhu? I will say no. Ah, who said it? Baba? Okay. Arundhati. Yes, we can hardly imagine. Holy Mother was not yet 33 years old. That Sri Ramakrishna was her whole life. Her husband, her guru, her Ishta Devata, her chosen ideal, everything. And then at that young age, she finds herself a widow, and the grief that she must have felt is something unimaginable. Even the direct disciples, we hardly think about this, how that affected them. You know, towards the end of Thakur's life, he said that if it weren't for the fact that I know that all of you will wander the streets weeping after I pass away, I would give up the body even now. He said, what point is there for me to continue with all of this pain and suffering? But I know that that will happen, and it really happened. They say that, I don't remember if one of the direct disciples said that sometimes after Thakur passed away, that they would hear Swamiji weeping at night so much that when he got up, they would see the whole pillow was soaked with tears. So it was even worse for Holy Mother. And we hear that after he passed away, she lost all desire to live, even. This is why they arranged that pilgrimage for her to go to Vrindavan. And fortunately, Sri Ramakrishna revealed himself to her on several occasions. She had different experiences and visions, mostly to do with her bangles. When she tried to take her bangles off, he would appear. And she felt his hand, even. So it was something very real to her. And he said, no, that the bangles are taken off when one becomes a widow and when a husband dies, but I haven't died. See how easy of access, as if I just went into a different room. So having this vision of Sri Ramakrishna from time to time, and then having her own disciples, and then Radhu, of course. And then Radhu, that was that yogamaya, that little trick that Sri Ramakrishna played, that a little attachment would come on the part of Holy Mother to Radhu, her niece, so that she would be connected enough with the world to remain in the world. Otherwise, a tremendously difficult period for Holy Mother. She went to Kumarpakur because Sri Ramakrishna wanted her to. And this was very traditional. We were talking about this last night, that the daughter-in-law belongs to the family of the in-laws. Yeah. So even when she becomes a widow, especially in those days in an Orthodox village, she would be expected to live in Kumarpakur, not Jaranbati. Now, there was nobody there in Kumarpakur. And the few people, relatives, Thakur's relatives, didn't care for her. And she led a life of extreme poverty and extreme loneliness, and nobody to talk to. And the few people who were there made fun of her and laughed at her because she wasn't traditional enough. She still had her bangles. She had a little red border. The widows weren't supposed to do it. So it was a very, very difficult period. How she put up with that without complaining. Nobody even knew. Once Girish and Niranjan and Swamiji, once they found out about it, they said, no, we can't allow Mother to live like this. And then she went back to Jaranbati, and then they arranged, of course, for her place, a couple of different places in Calcutta. So this really is the greatest example of Holy Mother's power of forbearance, how she was able to deal with the terrible feeling of loss at the passing of Sri Ramakrishna. Then she had her crazy brothers, who were so jealous and always causing problems, and so many disciples that did all sorts of crazy things and everything. So her life was not simple. She had other nieces also besides Radhu that she had to look after, who were also a little bit unbalanced. So this is one of the reasons. It wasn't so much that she could put up with physical pain, but all of these other types of difficulties. Even her clothes, when she was in Kumarpakur, yes, this sari would get ripped and torn. She had to keep stitching it and everything. She had not a penny. Sometimes she would just pick some greens from the ground, and sometimes no rice, nothing like that. Anyhow, now we get to the second half of this. So this is the first half, that this is the greatest virtue, if we have this, then we can get to that greatest treasure in life, which is contentment. Now, contentment has different meanings. And Swami Sarvadevananda spoke very beautifully about this, that there's an ultimate type of contentment that comes when we have no desire for anything because the main desire in life is fulfilled. We've reached the goal of life. We've had that ultimate experience. We know who we really are. We feel that whatever was to be attained in life has been attained. So we're content. And any external things lose their value for us. So it's not that contentment or satisfaction comes when we fulfill desires. It comes when we have no desires, because the ultimate desire has been fulfilled. So this is that ultimate type of contentment, which is the goal of life. We're trying to achieve that ultimate contentment that will never be removed from us and is not dependent upon anything external. But there's another important aspect to this contentment, and that is that it is something that we practice, that we have to take this as part of our sadhana, our spiritual practice. Now, how do we do it? There are a couple of expressions we find in this in Gita, that one says, santushto yena kenachit, that this is one of the signs of a spiritual person, that they're content with anything, whatever comes. The other is, yadritcha labha santushta. They mean almost the same thing, that whatever comes of its own, that we're satisfied with that. Now, this is another case where it's a little too high for us, that we can't just sit outside and say, if somebody brings food, then it's okay, I'll eat. If they don't, I won't eat. Swamiji could do that. He did it on several occasions when he was wandering, and miraculously, somebody brings something for him. No miracles will take place if we do it. Maybe once, we'll get lucky or something. But so for us, we have to put forth, again, some reasonable type of effort. After making an effort, then we're content with what comes from it. So we have to practice a contentment with regard not to having no effort, but with regard to the results of our effort. So this is a spiritual type of practice. And it also can be practiced in terms of moderation. How much do we really need? We have to make a distinction between our wants and our needs. And how little can we have and feel perfectly content? People, if we look in this world, people who are content are not people who have a lot of things and who have had all of their desires for things fulfilled. They're people with very few desires and very simple desires. So this is another way to practice this contentment, simplicity. To see what things do we really need, what things are we running after that we won't even enjoy so much if we get them. And if we get them, will we be worried about losing it? So this is another way to practice this type of contentment. Now, I want to talk about one other type of contentment that we almost never talk about. And maybe we even look down upon it. And this is the contentment that comes from leading a good life. And it doesn't have anything to do with being a very spiritual or religious person. That there are people in this world who lead a life of unselfishness, lead a life dedicated to family, to career, to society, who do good works, who don't care for name and fame, that they fulfill all of their obligations in this world, and at the end of their life, they have a certain type of contentment. Now, we may say, oh, that's worldly and it's not spiritual, but it's very important. And if we can live in such a way that at the end of our life, we can say that, yes, I fulfilled my obligations, that I raised a family, children are well off, they all went to college, I looked after parents, I did something contributing to society, all of this, I'm content. It's a very important thing, a very wonderful thing. And if we don't have that, then meditation is difficult. Mind will be disturbed with different things. So we really have to look at this aspect of our life as well. Now, the same principle can be applied to our spiritual life in the sense that we want to reach, when we reach the end of life, we want to be able to say that I did everything I could have done. I'm content that I didn't waste my time, that I didn't postpone things. I didn't say, oh, I'll do my spiritual practice later, that I followed the routine, whatever I was asked to do by the guru, I did that. Whether I get God realization or not, I know that I gave a very sincere effort. I'm content. It's very important. There's an expression that athletes use sometimes, these football players especially, that afterwards they'll be interviewed, and they say, well, one thing I can say is I left everything on the field. Huh? That means that they didn't, every last drop of energy and effort that they had, they expended. So there's a certain type of contentment. I couldn't have done anything more. We lost, but I left everything on the field. So at the end of life, I didn't realize God, but I didn't hold back. I did everything possible according to my ability. So there's even that, there'll be a certain type of contentment that comes from that. I'm trying to find one thing because I like it very much that I may have skipped over. It's that serenity prayer. Well, this was going back to this idea of how much do we try to change things with forbearance. You know the serenity prayer? Anybody know exactly? Oh, Lord, give me the power to change the things that I can change and the power to accept the things that I can't and the wisdom to know the difference. Yeah, the very good rule of thumb. How do we know when we simply just put up with something? Well, if it can be changed and fixed, we do it. If it can't, we accept it, and we hope that we know the difference between them. Okay, now briefly, because it's a little late, I want to get to Holy Mother's final message. Final because it was the last, not the last utterance, but the last real teaching that she gave, but also final in the sense that it's so important. And let me read it in the original Bengali because it's beautiful. Many people recite this and repeat it at different times. Tobe ekti kotha boli, jodi shanti chao ma karo dosh dekho na. Dosh dekhbe nije. Jogotke apnar kore nite shekho. Keho por noy ma, jogot tomar. This was a statement that the Holy Mother made to a devotee known as Annapurna's mother. Annapurna Ma, it was just, I think, 5 days before she passed away. At that time, no one was allowed in her room, but Holy Mother saw this Annapurna mother and asked her to come in. And Annapurna Ma, mother saluted Holy Mother, began to weep. And then she said, Mother, what will happen to us? And Holy Mother replied, why should you be afraid? You've seen the Master. What should frighten you? She was a great devotee. Then she said those famous words, let me tell you something, my child. If you want peace, do not find fault with others. Rather, see your own faults. Learn to make the world your own. No one is a stranger, my child. The whole world is your own. This was the last great teaching. A couple days later, she said that to one of her attendants, that Sharat is there, Swami Sharadananda. Why should you be afraid? Otherwise, this was she didn't say anything else after that. Now, this is another thing that's a little bit confusing. What does it mean not to see the faults of others? For Holy Mother, it was literal. She used to say that old people criticize Golap, that she was too talkative and too rough and everything. She said, I don't see any fault in her. And she used to pray to the Divine Mother, please remove this tendency of seeing faults in others. And she would say, look, the world is full of people who see the faults of others. The world won't suffer at all if there's one person who doesn't see the faults of others. Now, did it mean that she didn't see that there was injustice, that there are people doing things that are not right? She had to see things. She was a guru. She had to be able to instruct her student. But she didn't see it the same way we see it as a fault. For us, we can practice this as trying not to find fault, not to look at it, look for faults in other people. We have plenty of our own faults. We know that. Now, one way that I always find helpful of understanding this is the story of the scorpion and the saint, the holy man and the scorpion, that each time the scorpion stings the saint, it ends up falling back in the water, and the saint saves it, and it stings it, and it goes back and forth. And then the saint explained that, look, this is the nature of the scorpion. So that means the saint didn't see it as a fault, didn't criticize it or anything. This is the nature. Swabhava. We all have our own nature. We act in accordance to our own nature. He said, why should I be angry? This is the nature. So he saw it as a quality or characteristic, not a dosha. Dosha is a fault. So this is one very nice way of trying to understand this, that each and every one of us acts in accordance with our personality and with our all sorts of things, our insecurities, our jealousies, and all of that, that we're not always free to react in a very high way. Sometimes we're just acting out of these lower tendencies that we have. This is what it means to take a charitable view of people. And we have to understand that sometimes we have to hope others take a charitable view of us, that we're acting like the scorpion. Yeah? And we hope that they don't criticize us too much and that they are a little bit, as I say, charitable in their view and say, this is their nature, it's okay, I won't take it personally. So this is a very helpful way to try to understand this great teaching of Holy Mother. And we should just refrain. We all like to find faults in other people. It's fun. And talk about it. Somebody was telling me this PCPN. Huh? Is that what you call it? No, PNPC. PNPC. I never heard this expression. Everybody knows it. PNPC. Yeah. Paraninda, paracharcha. That means we get great fun in talking about people behind their back and criticizing them. Yeah. It's a hobby. Huh. Yeah. It's not a very good thing. We should really try not to do that. Now, I just want to point out one other thing in this statement. Why should we avoid this? Well, of course, it's good for us. But it's not that Holy Mother is saying, this is a terrible thing, it's a very sinful thing. Look at the first words. She says, Jodi Shanti Chaoma, if you want peace. So it's for our benefit that we're the ones who will grow spiritually. We're the ones that will be relieved of all of this mental churning of the mind, all of these things, if we can practice this. So this is really, she's telling us something that's for our own benefit and for our own good. So if we can follow it, she's saying you don't have to follow it. If you want peace of mind, then follow it. So we have to decide, do we get more pleasure out of gossiping and talking about people? It's fun. I do it. Yeah, it's not a good thing. Yeah, we all do it because we're human beings. Huh? But those who refrain from it, and we see people like that, their mind is not in that direction. So this person has that fault. So what? What is that to me? I have plenty of faults. Then we find these people are very peaceful type of people. So Holy Mother, and I'll close with this last quote. Holy Mother, in the same context earlier, said, a person finds faults in others after bringing down his own mind to that level. Does anything ever happen to another if you enumerate his faults? It only injures you. This has been my attitude. Hence, I cannot see anybody's faults. If anyone does a trifle for me, I try to remember him even for that. To see the faults of others, one should never do it. I never do it. Forgiveness is a spiritual austerity itself. So I will stop here and we can sit for a few minutes. Right.
Sharanam Devim Ramakrishnam Jagadgurum Pada Padme Tayo Shritva Pranamami Muhurmuhuh.
I take refuge at the lotus feet of the Divine Mother, Sharada Devi, and Sri Ramakrishna, the World Guru, and bow before them again and again. So as I said earlier, we will have our